This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi, folks. This is Bob Main. Welcome to another episode of the Middle of the Week MSP Modern Self-Protection Podcast, normally hosted by Ben Branham. However, we are throwing a little bit of variety into this once in a while, and Ben's probably going to be back next week. I'm pretty fairly sure about that. You know, last week, in the middle of the week, Ben and I talked about home security. Hopefully, you guys got a lot out of that. If you have any more questions about that, please feel free to contact us. This is continuing with the survival and preparedness theme. I had a chance to interview Glenn Tate. Now, if you recall, Glenn Tate was on the Gun Dudes about, I don't know, back in April or May, something like that. He's written a book on survival and preparedness. And one thing I like about Glenn, he's kind of like me. He's an everyday guy. And he's a no tinfoil hatter. That's me. I'm a no tinfoil hatter. Even when it comes to guns, I don't believe in getting all this all tinfoil hattish. What I mean by that is, for example, you know, you got people who are thinking, oh, man, we're going to have gun control one day, and they're going to come after our guns and take them away. Yeah, right. Like, government officials are going to be knocking on your door saying, hand over your guns. That's just not very likely. You know, remember the episode where John Hadaway and I talked about the difference between possible and probable? You know, is that possible? Yes. Is it probable? No. You know, think about the massive undertaking that it would take to get 200 million firearms out of the hands of United States citizens. You know, we got much bigger problems in the United States of America right now than to try to go get guns away from everybody. You know, but that's the kind of tinfoil hattery that a lot of people engage in. So that's what I like about Glenn, is he doesn't get into that stuff. And it's a pretty good book. And so you're going to hear him talk about it. Now, I want to say this right before I turn him on. If you want to buy his book, it's called 299 Days. Go to handgunworld.com. I've set up a separate page called Recommended Books. And you can buy this book through Amazon if you go to my page. And it'll help me out. You know, I'll get a little bit of a fee for you hopping over to my page. So go to handgunworld.com and click Recommended Books. And then you'll see a direct link where you can purchase 299 Days by Glenn Tate. All right, just a brief break, and here comes the interview with Glenn.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and other listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit GunRightsRadio.com and click on the Forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership. GunRightsRadio.com.
My guest for this week's Middle of the Week show is Glenn Tate. How you doing, Glenn?
Doing great, Bob. Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. I appreciate you donating your time. Thanks for coming on the Handgun World podcast. And as many of the listeners know, I'm dedicating the middle of the week shows, at least for a while, not permanently, to the preparedness subject. Last week, Ben and I talked about home security and stuff like that. So I've got you on to talk about your book coming out. Now, I know you want to talk about your book. And just for the listeners' benefit, I've also asked Glenn to kind of talk about some of the things that he foresees this for the future of this country and stuff. So I'm sure he'll speak to that. Glenn, your book is 299 days, right?
That's right. 299 days, the number 299 days.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's called 299 days, 299 days. Where can people find it?
Primarily Amazon. It's there, and you can search for 299 days. Book one and book two are currently out. It's a 10-book series. Book three and four will be coming out in mid-November, and then two book sets will be released approximately every 3 months. All these books are written, so don't think that if you start this series, I'm going to try to slap two books together in a three-month time period or something. They're written. And so, yeah, that's how that is. There are a couple other places selling it online. The best way to get pointed towards a place to buy it other than Amazon would be to go to the website, 299days.com, and we can point you in the right direction.
Okay, and just for listeners' benefit, I will also put a link in my show notes on the blog page and also on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum. There'll be a link to how to find Glenn's book on Amazon, so check that out at my website. Well, one of the things I like about you, Glenn, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on the show is because you're kind of like me. You're kind of like an everyday guy, and you sort of believe in the no tinfoil hat philosophy that I believe in. Talk a little bit about that and kind of what got you motivated to write this book on prepping called 299 Days.
Yeah, we share a common vision, and that is no tinfoil hat stuff. I don't believe aliens are coming down from space. I don't believe there's a secret meteor strike that only I know about because I'm smarter than everyone else on Earth and everyone should listen to me. I don't believe in some of the wacky ideas about a collapse. I don't think you need to come up with complicated theories about why the United States is in for, in my opinion, a very tough time, because reality is far better of a predictor than crazy theories. The reality that I see, and I should pause for a moment and say, my job in real life allows me to observe government at a rather high level. I get to see things. I know folks in the government, and primarily in the state of Washington. That's where I'm based, Washington State. And I get to see things and sit in conference rooms and have friends that sit in conference rooms that get to observe amazing things. And there is no gigantic conspiracy. All it is primarily is debt. The state of Washington and the United States of America has far, far, far too much debt, governmental debt, and of course people have lots of personal debt. The college or student loan debt, I think, is over $1 trillion now, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so there's way, way too much debt. It's unsustainable. As a mathematical matter, it is impossible for the economy to be productive enough for us to pay the government debt and even in some ways pay the personal debt. So it's unsustainable. That's the key word. It's unsustainable. So what does that mean? That means that the government will no longer be able to spend the money that it currently spends. A large portion the United States is dependent in one way or another on the government spending money on them. And so when that slowly starts to unravel, there will be a political backlash. People will say, wait a minute, I used to get all this free stuff. Why aren't you giving me this stuff? You're giving this guy stuff and
her
stuff, but why not me? And that's what typically happens when things go bad. People start fighting amongst themselves. I think there will be a big event. Well, I should back up. There's a slow boiling problem that I just described. I think people see it in everyday headlines. They see Greece. They see things like that. They understand what's going on. I think there would be a large event. I don't think it'll be complicated or conspiratorial. I think it'll involve the value of the U.S. dollar. As you know, the U.S. is in the very enviable position of being the world reserve currency. And so we can do a bunch of crazy things and print too much money and spend too much money. And the rest of the world just has to deal with it. Well, they're not going to enjoy just putting up with us for too much longer. And I think that there would be an announcement of some kind that the dollar won't be the world reserve currency. There would be a giant devaluation of the dollar. I don't think this happens overnight. The book Patriots portrays this as happening virtually instantly. I don't think it will. I think that people will have investments and they won't want, even foreign investors, they won't want their investments to instantly evaporate. So it'll take some time, a period of days or weeks or something like that, and people will be able to see that this is happening. I don't think necessarily that all of a sudden there'll be a flash in the sky and you know, the world will end. I think we'll have some warning. Now, you need to start doing things about that now. So that's what I foresee. And then as a consequence, things will cost a lot of money. Gasoline will be extremely expensive.
It already is.
Well, that's true. Even more expensive. It's double what it was 4 years ago. And in part because the dollar is devaluated. And so we will see people panic. Some will go out and buy all the gasoline they can and go to the grocery stores and buy all the Doritos they can. In the book, I repeatedly make fun of Doritos. I don't know where that came from, but I just, you know, it sort of encapsulates some portion of the United States that just thinks that Doritos are, you know, it's sort of the way it is. We're all living in a convenience store kind of world, I think. Not all of us, people listening to you are. But so there'll be shortages and there'll be panic. And I think that will lead to a lack of law and order. The police will be overtaxed. I think that this book is entirely different from every other book out there for one reason, and that's because I foresee a partial collapse. I don't think that there will be zombies and cannibals and Mad Max and all that kind of stuff, because my theory is that the more dramatic something is, the less likely it is to occur. And I just don't think we'll be living in that kind of world. I think that when there's a lack of law and order, there will still be law and order. And in fact, in a place where you live or others live, there might be kind of a normal amount of law and order, which is another reason not to be crazy and go off and commit a bunch of crimes, besides the fact that crimes are immoral and you need to be a decent person.
Yeah.
There very likely will be law enforcement existing at the time, or there could be, after a short period of time, law enforcement reappearing. So, you know, if you think out there, and your listeners probably don't, but I just need to say this because I think our community, the prepper community, has such a bad name sometimes. If you think that a collapse of the United States is a great excuse to go out and shoot people, please don't buy my book. Please don't listen to Bob Main's podcast.
Exactly. I 100% agree with you. 100% agree with you. Yeah.
And that's not the approach in here, but it's a partial collapse. And the reason the book is different is that I describe things like the utilities stay on. There are brief periods in which they don't stay on. The reason they stay on, I won't spoil, comes up in some other books, I think is very fascinating, and I think it's very realistic why the utilities would stay on. That's kind of counterintuitive in the prepper novel world. You mean the utilities stay on? I mean, that's crazy. We can't have that. I think that the cities will not be pleasant places to live, but I think there will be a pretty decent level of government services functioning, because the government will concentrate all of its resources on cities and making sure that they stay under control. In the book, since this all takes place in Washington State, it's Seattle and the state capital of Olympia that are the strongholds, if you will. And outside of the cities, as you go out from there, you'll see varying levels of governmental services. And farther out you get in the country, the fewer governmental services there'll be. And out in the country, there will be self-sufficiency, not entire and complete self-sufficiency. Another thing that's different about this book, I don't see people all of a sudden planting a garden and eating all the food they need from their garden from the get-go. Let's say, you know, this happens in the middle of winter. I don't think people will just have gardens springing up.
Exactly.
They will be relying in some part on government food that's distributed through a freedom cards, as I talk about in the book, which are based on everybody's life savings and Social Security and all the other funds in banks. The government decides to nationalize all those funds. But in exchange, don't worry, citizens, you're going to get something. You're going to get a freedom card, which is a little card that allows you to go to a grocery store and get a bunch of, you know, freeze-dried mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I think we know that that's coming. I think we know that that's coming.
Absolutely. I can't imagine how you can have the kind of debt this country has, and then you have the amount of savings we have. We don't have enough savings, but we've got a few trillion dollars sitting, you know, electronically in accounts somewhere, and then the government wouldn't look at that big, fat, juicy chunk of money and not think to themselves, we're the government. We can spend that better than the people. I mean, I've...
Well, they're already doing that.
Well, I've been in conference rooms where government people have said we can spend money better than the little people.
Is that right? Really?
Something I added, the little people thing. Yeah, I think that, and this is a generalization. Don't forget, I live in Washington State, which is one of the most left-wing. I'm trying not to be political. Believe me, I'm not a partisan guy. I don't care about that stuff, much like you. But some government people in power really think that they can spend money better than anybody else, and they get a little miffed when we, the taxpayers, don't fork over more money to let the brilliant people like them go spend. And so I think they would seize on these accounts. And then in the book, the Freedom Cards, which are called F Cards. That's kind of a little funny joke there. They're used in varying degrees by people. If you're out in the country, there might be a shipment of food. The government nationalizes the diesel fuel and all the trucks, and the highways are pretty secure because they need to be. And the government gets some food, not enough, but some food out to the rural areas, and people pay for it with the F cards. So that is another example of this not being a complete collapse. Number one, I think that's more realistic. And number two, it adds complications. You've got now people that have to garden a little bit. There's a little bit of charity. I think there's going to be a ton of charity when all this happens. There will be so many people, so many sheepdogs, so many people like us, Bob, who are going to help people. And there'll be that, and then there'll be a little bit of government food coming in. And so through these various sources, I don't think there will be a mass starvation. I don't want to believe that, first of all. And second of all, it gets to that thing about the more dramatic something is, the less likely it is to occur. So that's the partial collapse that's depicted in these 10 books. And it's one of the reasons I think that the first publisher I sent this to, I'm not an author. I'm a regular guy. I have a white-collar job. I have a day job.
Right.
And, I sent this book to the first publisher, Prepper Press, and they called me right back and were very interested. I think it's because nobody's talking about the, in my view, more realistic partial collapse. Books about complete collapses are great to read. There are a bunch of them. Patriots comes to mind, One Second After.
Exactly, and those are good.
And it's great. It's great to wake people up and make them think, what if? And there's a lot of, first of all, entertainment in them, but second of all, a lot of good information, and people should read total collapse books. They really should. They should also read a partial collapse book because it'll give you another view. And speaking of another view, there are a lot of characters in the book, many of whom are based on real people, by the way.
Uh-huh.
The main character is me. It's autobiographical. pardon me for, you know, indulging myself in that, but it's the only person I could write about because I don't have that great of an imagination. I write about real things. But you get to see the viewpoint of people who are people who love the government taking care of them. They're sort of on the other side of you and me, and they describe... One of the characters is in the book is my sister, who's a professor in Seattle. And she describes how great it is that the government is taking care of everybody. And so you see it from a variety of viewpoints. This isn't rah, 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 government's bad, all these other things. It is viewpoints from the other side. Then there are people who change their minds, who start off thinking, the government's working great. They're working for me. This is awesome. And then they change their minds midway through. And so it's real because people really do come from different viewpoints and they really do change their minds when a big event happens.
Right.
Will change. And it's another part of this book that is important besides the partial collapse is normalcy bias. You've talked about it a lot. I think the term describes what the problem is with normalcy bias, but you get to see it from a variety of angles in this book, particularly my wife in the book, who just is, she, you know, grew up upper middle class and just cannot believe that bad things would happen, and she wonders why, you know, I'm so crazy and doing all these things. And then she just, in the beginning of the book at least, cannot believe that these things could possibly happen and wants desperately for things to be normal. That's the part of normalcy bias that gets people killed.
Well, sure it is, yeah. And that's the problem is, you know, they don't, it's the same thing with with firearms because, you know, this show is primarily about firearms, although I'm trying to wake people up to the need of prepping, which is one reason why I brought you on. But a lot of people don't want to believe that a bad guy could bust into their house or could attack them on the street. And so therefore they wonder, gee, why would anybody need to carry a gun? It's the same thing you're talking about. People don't want to believe that we could be in a situation in this country where services, just general services, could be quite scarce. And like, and you hit the nail on the head, you know, the debt problem, the runaway spending, you know, the spending that government officials that you have witnessed saying that think, well, this, we can just do this and there's no consequences for it. Well, I got news for people. The ones that are going to be paying the consequences for what these knuckleheads are doing are you, me, and everybody listening to this show.
Yeah, and another thing in the book that I think is going to be really interesting to your listeners. I assume most of your listeners are like me and you, and they're sheepdogs. I'm sure you know that phrase. I think you've used it too, but
I have, yes.
Right, who are the sheepdogs look after the sheep. The sheep are kind of ignorant, and there are wolves out there that want to eat the sheep. And the sheepdogs are a unique breed. They protect sheep, and they really don't have any incentive to. They're just built that way. They're wired that way. Well, throughout the book, there are a bunch of sheepdogs from various backgrounds, some military people, some law enforcement people, lots of regular civilians, men, women, you know, people of all different races, all kinds of people. Because in my world, that's who sheepdogs are. They're a variety of people. But the sheepdogs go and do good things. And I don't mean comic book things. I don't mean, you know, charging machine gun nests and just all that kind of comic book stuff that I don't know. I'm so realistic and practical. I can't stand that exaggerated stuff. But the sheepdogs save the day, which is what I think is going to happen, and which is why I think it's fantastic that people carry concealed, for example. That's a sheepdog thing. Boy, I'll tell you, there's a lot of downside that comes to carrying concealed. I mean, people should do it. I'm not trying to convince people not to, but, you know, it costs money. You have to dress differently.
Right.
You have to get a license. Sometimes your spouse doesn't want you to. Sometimes you're just tired and you don't want to go and put that different belt on, you know, for that holster and stuff. And sheepdogs go about it and say, I'm going to make some sacrifices because I'm just the way I am, and I'm going to help people. Well, that concept magnified greatly plays out over and over again in this book in various ways. And that's what I'm really proud of. I think that people are going to have a new view of what preppers are like, and it's going to be a positive view, and it's going to be a realistic view.
Yeah, well, can I ask you a question about your
story?
I want to ask you about your story, because your story is quite compelling. I really like it. I did hear your interview with the Gun Dudes several months back where you told your story, and I kind of relate to it. And one of the things that I think is kind of neat is you said you began the writing and you began doing some of this stuff all at first in secret, right?
Absolutely. I took 2.5 years to write this, and the entire 2.5 year period, I did this secretly. My wife had no idea I was writing a 3,200 page, 10 book series, just kind of hard to pull off. and I would get up at 3:30 or 4 in the morning and write for a few hours. And I did that for about 2.5 years. This whole story started off because of the secrecy. My wife now knows about the book. I mean, obviously, you know, can't hide that from her. She knows about this. But in the beginning, she was resistant to the idea of prepping. And so I had to do this secretly. So the way the book started is the Easter Bunny. I was prepping secretly, and I thought, okay, when some event happens and it's entirely apparent that we need to bug in or we need to bug out, I need to have an explanation for why all this food materialized in the garage, why all these firearms, all these guns she's never seen materialized, ammo cans, you know, water filters and all kinds of first aid stuff and all that. How did this stuff just come about? Well, there's two approaches to that. I could say, I told you so, honey. You were wrong. You didn't want to prep. I did it, and I had to do it. And so I'm right. You're wrong. We're doing things my way. There's a crisis. That's one approach.
That's not a very good approach.
That's a terrible approach for a variety of reasons. And the second approach is to the approach I took is to be humble, and that's where the Easter Bunny comes in. I took the Easter Bunny approach, and that is to say, honey, you might notice there's a bunch of supplies in the garage. The Easter Bunny dropped them off, and just leave it at that. And that's a way to save face. And instead of talking about I was right and you're wrong, the Easter Bunny dropped these off. Now, how are we going to make sure the kids are comforted, and how are we going to get to safety if that's what we need to do? How are we going to do all the things as a family that we need to do to make it through this bad situation and then return life to normal as quickly as possible? I'm all for that.
Yeah.
So I started outlining this Easter Bunny speech, because as I foresaw it, there would be a big event and I would have to give the Easter Bunny speech. And I thought, this is probably the most important discussion I'm ever going to have with my wife, because it's a life or death situation. And so I need to get this speech right. I need to do this well. So I started outlining it, and I outlined things like why the collapse has come, what I did to prepare for it, what we need to do going forward. And this outline kept getting longer and longer. Again, this is an extremely important discussion I'm having.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And so it got longer and longer and longer. And then I looked at this and I thought, my goodness, this Easter Bunny speech is a perfect description of why people need to prep, how they need to prep, and what they need to do in a crisis situation. And I thought, wow, this would maybe help some people out and be interesting. So I thought, well, I'll write a short story. It'll basically be the Easter Bunny speech. It'll be a few pages, and that'd be kind of neat. I'd put it on a forum or something, and maybe a few people read it. And then as I started working on the Easter Bunny speech, I said, well, I need to describe context. I need to describe how things happened, and it got longer. And then I said, well, maybe this would be a short book, but gee, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'll publish it on my own and maybe, you know, sell 100 copies to friends or something like that. Then I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. I got inspired. I would get up. I would wake up, Bob. I would spring up in bed at about 3:30.
No kidding?
I would spring up, and I had a chapter outlined in my head. I would sit down, and the keyboard would start clacking away, and all of a sudden it was 6 or 6:30, and I was hungry, and all of a sudden these chapters just kept – they would just flow out of me. And pretty soon, 2.5 years being pretty soon, I had 3,200 pages. And I said, well, okay, I can self-publish this, but, you know, maybe a publisher would be interested. That's when I contacted Prepper Press. And as they say, the rest is history. We broke it into 10 books because this would be way too big to do otherwise. And then that's what happened. And now it's out there. I've been talking about it quite a bit. The reaction has been absolutely astounding. I'm a humble guy. I happen to have a story that a lot of people can relate to, because it's a guy
right.
who has to prep in secret, and there's resistance, and he does it anyway. And it's really resonated. And I get emails from people. I get personal messages on Facebook and on forums. And people say things. The highest compliment they pay me is they say, my wife or husband. There are some husbands out there who have normalcy bias, and some wives who are prepping. We can't forget that.
Right.
They say, my spouse was not down with this very important program, and I've convinced them that we need to prep because they read book one and two. And I get goosebumps even saying that. That is the highest honor out there.
Sure it is. Sure it is. You know,
what I love.
It is the highest honor, and I've said that many times. You know, even when people say to me that something that I've done or said or put on the show has, you know, helped them change their life in some way, it is a high honor, and I don't take that lightly, and I think that you've experienced that. You know what that's all about.
Yeah, I've lived it, and that's the neat thing. I've gone through a very difficult struggle and come out doing okay with it, and I want to share that. I want to get as many people out there taking care of what they need to take care of for what I really, truly believe is coming, and it's possible if you prepare, especially with a partial collapse like I envision. It is it's possible to live through it, perhaps even be moderately comfortable through the whole thing, and then to recover as quickly as possible, and then get back on with your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely doable if you take some reasonable steps here. And that's one of the things I talk about in the book, is I didn't go crazy on this. It's very easy to get emotional and get scared and to start ordering thousands of dollars of freeze-dried food and putting it on a credit card. That's a bad approach for a variety of reasons. And I had a deal with my daughter, teenage daughter. I told her what I was doing, and I said, if your dad is starting to be unreasonable, you get to tell me. And I talk about this in the book. How empowering for a 14, 15-year-old girl to be told by her dad that if her dad's doing something unreasonable, she's the one who gets to decide what's reasonable or not. But I thought it was important to have a check of some kind. Teenager's judgment maybe isn't the best check to have on yourself, but anyway, have a little check on myself, because you have to approach this reasonably and rationally. And that's what I've done. And that story of how that happened is something that is going to get out there and is going to help other folks do this reasonably and rationally. And that's terrific.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Now, I understand that, you know, you're in government, you can't talk too much about that, and I understand that, you know, you go to great lengths to try to keep that under wraps because it could affect you and your career and things like that. But other than the spending, what else do you kind of see out there that is taking place that you want to kind of alert people to?
Well, I see some. And I'm not a tinfoil hat guy, but I need to answer your question.
Yeah, no, I'm not a tinfoil hatter either.
But I do see some troubling civil liberties issues going on. I think the passage by both political parties, I'd like to add, the passage of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, is very troubling to me.
Yep.
It really does. I've read it. I mean, this is not made up stuff. It really does allow the President of the United States or his or her designees, who could be anybody in the federal government, to say that people can be picked up, detained without trial, tried, imprisoned, and killed. I don't think it'll happen often. That's the non-tinfoil hat part of this. But the fact that that's possible, it's very troubling to me. I don't think the government has the resources to pull off full-on oppression. And what I mean by that is, and this is described at length in the book, they may want to do bad things. Some people within government may want to do bad things. I think that there will be plenty of military and law enforcement people, the oath keepers, people that are part of an organization where they pledge to keep their oath to the Constitution, which is to not violate the Constitution. Every military and law enforcement person takes an oath to obey the Constitution. That's where
right.
the term comes from.
Right.
So I think there'll be oath keepers that will prevent bad guys in government from doing really bad things, but also there won't be resources. The government would need a tremendous amount of fuel, spare parts, and personnel who are willing to do all these bad things. And I don't think, even in a partial collapse, they're going to have the fuel, spare parts, or personnel to do all these things. So the good news and the hope from this book is the government can't pull it off. And that's an important reality check. So I think there's troubling civil liberties things. I see troubling political trends. I spend a fair amount of my day thinking about politics, to be quite honest.
Because that's your full-time job, right?
Well, yeah. I think it's fair to say I'm an observer of government.
Yeah.
I don't want to imply that I'm, super secret spy guy or something.
Okay, for those that might have noticed a little bit of a chop in the flow of the conversation here, I had to take a break to take care of some business because I'm doing a little multitasking. But anyway, Glenn, we were talking about some of the troubling things out there. You were talking about the NDAA Act, which I agree with you on that. It should not be we should not be giving any government official that power. And I am troubled by that. I'm kind of like you. I kind of feel that it would be very, very difficult for the government to be able to crack down on every human being in the United States. I think there's a lot of tinfoil hatters out there that like to spread it around and say stuff like, oh my God, they could be doing all these kinds of nasty things to us. Logistically, that's very tough. You know, it's kind of like the person that says, well, the government's going to come take our guns away. Stop and think about that for a minute. Do you know how big of an undertaking that would be to get a couple hundred million firearms out of the hands of people in the United States? That would just be, a huge undertaking. I think the government has bigger problems to worry about.
Exactly right, and that's a great summary of why I don't think there will be massive oppression in the United States. I just don't see it coming. Another trend out there that I see that is troubling is partially political and partially social, and that is the fact that 47% of U.S. households are not paying income taxes. It's 49.1%. You can tell I'm around government a lot, right, with all these figures. 49.1% of households receive a federal benefit program of some kind.
Can I stop you right there?
You bet.
You are 100% correct. And I'm going to tell you, this is not directed to you, Glenn. This is directed to some people out there. I'm going to try not to get too political here. It really, really upsets me when people make a big deal about the 47% comment that Mitt Romney made. Now, I'm not a huge Mitt Romney supporter. This is not supposed to be political. But he was talking about what you're talking about right now, Glenn. He was talking about the fact that nearly half of the households get government aid. And quite frankly, when you think about it, he was telling the truth. I wish people would quit beating the man up because he was telling the truth. Perhaps he didn't choose his words properly. You know, oh, wow, surprise, surprise. A politician didn't choose his words properly, right? They all do that, don't they?
That's right.
You know, but that's what he's talking about. Now, I do want to put a caveat in here, though. Unfortunately, the veterans, the ex-military people are also getting money that is counted as government assistance, and it shouldn't be. I mean, a veteran's pension, I mean, you know, good Lord, they served our country, and I respect them and I salute them, and they deserve what they get. That should not be counted as government assistance. That is counted in the total figure. I don't know if you know that or not.
Yeah, it is, and that's a good point. I have several friends who are military veterans, and quite a few of them have injuries, and they're not the dramatic injuries. They're, you know, bad backs and things, and they basically donated their bodies for a great cause, and now they're being paid a little bit, not enough, in pensions and VA benefits to make up for that. So you're right, and when I say that 49.1% of households receive government benefits of some kind, some of it has been paid for in the past. To an extent, Social Security has been paid for. You get more out of it usually than you put into it, which is about 3-to-1. But anyway, I don't mean to get into statistics. So it's not all bad people. That's not my point. It's not 49.1% of households in America are bad, or 47% of the households who don't pay federal income tax are bad people. It's just a reality that half the country, in one way or another, is getting free stuff.
Yeah, they are. And here's the thing. And again, I want to say this one more time so I don't get hate mail. We're not pointing the finger at the veterans who served this country honorably and are getting money. They deserve that. That should not be counted. But let me ask you a question, Glenn. And again, and we'll get back to the survival subject here in a minute. Let's talk about the other half.
Yep.
Okay? The other half is footing the bill for the first half.
Absolutely. What are the figures? They change from time to time. The top 1% of federal income taxpayers pay, I don't know, 40 or 50% of the income taxes in the country. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true.
It's true.
And so you've got the very wealthy paying an incredibly disproportionate share of the amount of taxes. Guess what? More and more people, and I talk to them, who are in those categories are saying things like, why am I doing this? Why am I getting up early? Why am I risking all my money and my kids' inheritance to have a business when the government's just going to take it all in taxes? So people are starting to kind of drop out of the system, and that's bad for the economy. So politically speaking, you've got half of folks out there, and I was wrong when I said free stuff. You know what? You made me think about it. You're right. Veterans getting veterans benefits, that's not free stuff.
That's not free. They paid for that. Yes, that's right.
Now, the majority of the households receiving things are, they didn't do anything to get it. But anyway, so you've got a bunch of people, excluding veterans, who have gotten into some situation where they're getting free stuff. Politically and socially, that's very, very bad, because when the checks quit rolling or the EBT cards quit rolling, those people are going to get very, very upset, and they're going to be completely dependent, and they're going to be terrified because they have no ability to eat or do anything else, and that's a scary powder keg situation.
Okay, now, let me stop you there. I 100% agree with you. Let's talk about that, because this gets back to the survival and prepping subject here. I have said that before. I've said that many times. I've said that when things get bad and assistance starts getting cut off, which, you know, let's face it, that's what it's going to take in the USA right now to be able to turn things around. We're going to have to start cutting back benefits. When that happens, I think people are going to resort to desperate measures, and I think you might see more violence, and you might see more people doing some pretty crazy things. Would you agree?
Absolutely, and that is the genesis of the security problem that arises in a collapse. That is exactly what the problem is. A bunch of people who have no ability to take care of themselves. They're scared. I don't know. I've gone a while without food and without sleep. And you know, I get mean and nasty, and people will suggest things to me that make no sense, and they seem a little bit more believable. When these people are tired and hungry and scared to death, and somebody says, those people over there have stuff, let's go get it. That doesn't make any sense. You and me sitting here calmly, you know, talking about this, we'd say, well, that's crazy. Who would go do that? Well, they might in that situation. And then when you have even a few instances of this going on, you're going to overwhelm law enforcement and hospitals and everything else. You know, two words, LA riots. That's all you need to say to prove that to be true. Katrina, there's a one-word answer to that. So in quickly, very quickly, you will have the services overwhelmed, and then people are going to have to start taking care of themselves, and that's where sheepdogs and listeners to your podcasts are going to come in. By the way, as far as the depth of the problem, welfare spending, which excludes Social Security, Medicare, and Medaicaid, topped $1 trillion as of today, the day we're recording.
How much? How much?
$1 trillion with a T.
$1 trillion. You know, I mean...
In 1 year. That's in a one-year period. That's for fiscal year 2011. Okay, that's a big, big problem. $1 trillion. That's more money than the world has ever known or conceived of in the past. I mean, it's just... That's the social and political problem of dependence that I see going on there.
Do you mind if I put that in perspective?
I'd love it.
Okay. I'm doing this off the top of my head. I actually pulled out a calculator and did this a few months ago. I'm going to take a real educated guess, but I'm going to be pretty accurate here. Let me put it into context, or let me help people understand how much money $1 trillion is. If you were to lay on a table $1 per second, you ready for this? If you laid on a table a dollar bill every second, it would take 33,000 years to accumulate $1 trillion.
My goodness.
33,000 years at a dollar per second to accumulate $1 trillion. Now, I'm going to get out my calculator while you're speaking, and I'm going to verify my figures, but I'm pretty sure about that because there's 86,400 seconds in a day. I know that. So you go ahead and cover, and I'm going to verify that. But I want people to understand how. So when you hear that we are $1 trillion, that the deficit, not the debt, that the deficit is $1 trillion. If we paid it back a dollar a second, it would take 33,000 years.
The deficit this year is about $1.5 trillion. The trillion I was talking about and we're talking about is just the amount of welfare.
Oh, the amount of welfare. Okay, never mind. Yeah, okay.
Welfare, and that excludes Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which is even more. So that's a big problem. Well, while you're calculating this, I'll tell you about another trend that I see that is very disturbing. That's just-in-time inventory. I know that sounds all wonky or some MBA sort of thing, but it's not wonky. That's the inventory system we've decided to come up with in this country, in which there is very, very little inventory that a store or a manufacturing facility will keep on hand. They just have enough to basically do exactly what they need to do at that time. A classic example is a friend of mine was involved in putting jet engines together, and he said there would be one incredibly critical part. I mean, a jet engine doesn't get made without this part, and a jet doesn't fly without this one little teeny $30 part. It would come from Turkey. And not only would it come from Turkey, but it would arrive just in time so that the mechanic putting the engine together would have this one $30 piece within about a 10-minute window of when he needed to put it in there. And if the production was sped up or slowed down, that $35 part wouldn't be there and the thing wouldn't get built. And this assumes there are no earthquakes in Turkey, and there often are earthquakes in Turkey. So it shows you how fragile things are. The best way to describe this is how I described it in the book, where I went to the back of a grocery store one day. I was just curious. I was thinking, this something's wrong, something's amiss here with this economy of ours. And I went to the back and I watched all these semi-trucks rolling in and out at very regular intervals. And then I realized there wasn't any big storage facility. I mean, at the grocery store, the amount of food they had on the shelves was pretty much it.
Yeah.
And then a truck would come and let's pick on Doritos for a while. They might have a day or two of Doritos in this big grocery store. And then a truck, and I live on the West Coast, so probably from the LA area, comes 1,000 miles and drops off a pallet of Doritos and then does that the next 2 days and the next 2 days. Well, if you have disruptions in diesel fuel, the safety and security of that truck rolling up Interstate 5 from LA, or you're not paying truck drivers because you can't pay them or the money's not worth anything,
right,
all of a sudden, snap of a finger, you've only got a day or two worth of Doritos or yogurt or steak or potato, whatever it is. Medicine, that's going to be a big problem. So just-in-time inventory, the fragile nature of the American economy, relying on this incredibly complicated system of resupplying itself, is going to be a huge problem. It is no exaggeration. It is not tinfoil hat to say that the second America realizes there's a big problem, the grocery stores will be empty in a matter of, I think, minutes,
yeah,
maybe hours. It happens all the time. That's the thing that's so frustrating, Bob, is I tell people these things and they look at me like I'm crazy. And I just got done watching it on TV during the latest hurricane or something like that. I mean, this is not bold prediction on our part. It is looking at what always happens in a similar situation. So I think just-in-time inventory is a terrible trend. Another trend that I see that's alarming is the lack of skills. And I will admit, I'm in this boat. I've reacquired some skills. I grew up in a rural setting, poor. I grew up poor and in the country. And I had a bunch of skills in the past to take care of myself and, you know, maybe feed myself, maybe keep myself warm and those sorts of things. I lost them once I entered the white-collar world. But there, and so I don't have all the skills I need to have, so I'm guilty along with everybody else. But we have a lack of skills in this country. People don't know how to change tires. People don't know. My goodness, there's a state near me, Oregon, where they don't allow self-serve gasoline. Everything's full serve.
So I remember that. I remember traveling through Oregon. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody pumps your gas, and I watched a woman in an SUV with Oregon license plates up in Washington State at a gas station. She pulled into a gas station. She got out and she waited for somebody to fill up her gas tank. When nobody came out, because it's Washington, we have self-serve, she tried to pump her own gas. And I watched, and I wasn't laughing because it wasn't funny, but I just was in shock. She pulls out a credit card and starts waving it around the machine like there's just going to be some magic thing that's going to happen. She pulls the pump off. She didn't even know about unscrewing her gas tank lid and things. She didn't know how to put gas in her car.
You're kidding me.
And this is an extreme example. But there are a million important skills that most of us don't have. And when there aren't people, there aren't doctors and ER physicians, when there aren't people who know how to fix things, when those people aren't around because they can't get to us and we can't pay them with money that, you know, is worth anything, we're all going to be in a world of hurt. I mean, Bob, do you know how to fix your car with all the computers in it? I sure don't.
No, I don't. I don't.
And that's going to be a huge problem. So those are some trends, you know, political, social things, just-in-time inventory, and a lack of skills that, over and above the economic situation that I see being bad, are going to make this, I think, a really nasty problem, because we have it so good in this country that when we don't have it good for even a short period of time, the crash is going to be hard. I mean, we're all kind of like movie stars in a sense, and all of a sudden, you know, the caviar starts flowing and you know, it's going to be hard. Elsewhere in the world, they don't have all the stuff we have, and stuff going away is not as big of a deal to them because it's just another day for them. But it's going to be really, really hard on us, and that's that's a scary thing. So that's what I see.
Yeah, and you know, you just laid out the case nicely for, you know, what can happen from a common sense perspective. And thanks for doing that. We're close to wrapping up. I want to get back to something. My calculation was slightly off. It's 31,000 years. 31,000. But think about it. And the reason I'm kind of being anal about this, if you want to call it that, is, my God, a dollar a second, and it would take 31,000 years just to replenish $1 trillion, and you say that's how much, you know, is going out there in government assistance, and in our deficits, $1.5 trillion. You know, let these numbers sink in for a minute. I don't care who gets elected on November 6th. It's going to take a long, long time to turn this around. And I certainly hope that people aren't sitting back thinking, oh, well, gee, if the right guy wins on November 6th, a year later, we're all going to be happy and swimming in money and happiness again. No way. No way. It's going to take, I mean, with numbers like that, with deficits that can take thousands of years, well, let's say decades to pay back, with deficits that can take decades to pay back, I don't understand how people, if you're thinking that everything's going to be okay if the right guy gets elected, I let me urge you to think again.
And let me amplify that point, because it's important. If Mitt Romney wins, my prepping will not stop.
Me either.
The one thing that will be different if Romney wins is that ammunition prices will not spike as much. There won't be anybody, you know, telling me I can't buy an AR-15 anymore. So, I mean, there are differences, but still, it still goes on. And I can't rely, you can't rely, listeners can't rely on the government saving things. And we have to take care of ourselves, because we need to take care of our families. And we just do. I came to this conclusion very reluctantly. I want to be clear. I still have a pretty decent life, kind of a cool white collar job, and I'm very much a member of society. I talked about this in the past. I go to every governor's inaugural ball. Okay, every 4 years I have a tuxedo.
Wow.
I go to the governor's inaugural ball, and I fit in extremely well in polite society, and so I'm not some outcast or anything like that. I want things to be okay. I haven't given up on life, and I want things to collapse so I can say I told you so, and I can shoot some zombies, and I can live some fantasy life. And so I want things to get back to normal. But even I, a guy who runs in these circles, still is prepping, because I understand that I need to. And a quick thought, I know we're wrapping up. There are quite a few people in some of the upper levels of government, one in particular I've got to know well, who is a prepper. I mean, there are a fair number of folks who I think know what's going on, know that it's unsustainable, and they themselves are prepping. And when this person, I can't describe who it is, but this person in the position that he's in, laughed and said, yeah, it's completely unsustainable. He didn't laugh like, ha-ha. He was just like, oh, my goodness, it's completely clear to everybody. This is unsustainable, and here are all the things I'm doing to prepare for this. I thought, I'm a lot less crazy.
Exactly. And, you know, and you are a lot less crazy. And, well, this is good. This is good, Glenn. This was a great discussion here. And, you know, it's going to air in its entirety, and I think it's very good. So I hope that we've gotten some people's attention. If you haven't already been doing some common sense prepping, and let me underline the word common sense, get Glenn's book, 299 Days, 200. Hey, where'd you come up with the name 299 Days?
It's hopeful is the answer. The 299 days, and this is the first chapter and the last chapter, which is the 299th chapter. So the first and last chapters are the same. And in it, the main character is looking back at what happened from the day that the collapse kicked off until that day when he is going to the governor's inaugural ball. There's a new governor. See, this is all, when I said I based this on myself and this is real, this is what I was getting at. And so he's looking back at the 299 days that have gone on, and that's when the collapse has happened and a bunch of things in the book have happened. And he's looking back at the way things were and some of the things that happened, some of the sacrifices that were made, and the bittersweet fact that there's now a new governor and things are normal and restored enough for there to be an inaugural ball and how things are going to be different and his role in the new government, basically. And so it was a 299-day period. That's hopeful because, unlike other books where humanity is plunged into 1,000 years of darkness, we're plunged into 299 bad days, and then it ends. It doesn't end completely happily and wonderfully, and life gets back. But, I mean, things get way better in less than a year, because that's what I think is going to happen. I think America's that resilient, and I think that we can come back from this after a very painful period, and so that's where the name comes from.
Very good, very good. Well, I just want to let people know, before I let Glenn go, if you go to handgunworld.com, I just put a link to Glenn's book in a on a page on my website called Recommended Books. Yes. So, yes. And if you use my Amazon affiliate link, it'll help out my show. Buy Glenn's book. Go to handgunworld.com. Recommended Books is the page that I set up, and yours is the first one on the list.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Yeah, and please go through Bob's Amazon page, because people don't know this. It costs money to put on a podcast. And, you know, you shouldn't have to pay that out of pocket, Bob.
Well, I'm happy to do if I have to, but there are a lot of generous people that listen to my show, and I'm sure that if they want to get your book, they'll go through my link on my page. Again, that's called Recommended Books. On that page, you'll see the link. Glenn, thanks a lot. I appreciate this. You know, this was a good discussion. Would you mind coming back in a couple weeks and doing part two?
Oh, heck yeah. Anytime, Bob.
Okay, yeah, let's do part two coming up shortly, and Glenn Tate, thanks very much for taking this time.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too.
All right. Thank you, Glenn. Appreciate that. As you can tell, folks, I'm in my vehicle heading out to what I typically do, and that is getting out on the road selling a bunch of hotel security products. I got about 3 minutes before I get to my next stop. So in closing, I just want to let you know, thank you very much for listening to another Middle of the Week podcast. I've made some changes to my website. It's a huge resource of information for you. Check it out, handgunworld.com. For those of you who have been supporting my show, thank you very much, who've been financially supporting. As you know, I've set up the Shooters Club, which is an annual membership. It used to be just individual podcasts that I would sell. Now it's an annual membership. And Ben Branham and I are doing videos and audio podcasts. So you can see a description if you click Shooters Club page on the Handgun World page, or if you just go to Shooters Club members. You don't have to be a member to look at the page. You have to be a member to access the content. But go to shootersclubmembers.com. Check that out. That's the site that Ben and I have put together. We have posted a couple of videos. The first one is on shooting on the move. Ben and I both demonstrate shooting on the move. Ben also demonstrates how to effectively shoot an AR-15 rifle. The audio podcast on there right now is the continuation of my discussion with Masad Ayoub on open carry and constitutional carry. And very soon, probably by the time you hear this, I'm also going to post the recent discussion that John Hadaway and I had on mindset, which is pretty good. It's a continuation of what you heard in episode 200. Basically, staying out of trouble. That's what we talked about. Situational awareness, staying out of trouble. All important things for you to know if you're going to carry a gun. So check that out. Ben Branham and I also elaborated a whole lot more on home security, such as cameras and things like that, and how to mount them and what kind to buy, and some easy tricks when you're using surveillance cameras to protect your property and stuff like that. So all that is made available. If you want to sign up, you can sign up on either website, either handgunworld.com or shootersclubmembers.com, either one. And if you are a graduate of one of our classes, you get half price. If you are a law enforcement, military, or ex-military, or a first responder, you're going to get 25% off. Just email me, and I will send you the appropriate information to get signed up at a discount. Just email me, bob@handgunworld.com. I hope you got a lot from this interview with Glenn Tate. Sorry about the audio quality. For some reason, Skype kind of screwed up. Normally, I get a little bit better quality than that with the new way of recording that I have, but that one kind of goofed up, and I didn't realize it until after I had a chance to do the recording. I tried editing it as best as I could. I didn't cut out a single word. All I did was kind of spruce up the quality just a bit. It was worse. I apologize for that. All that being said, thanks for listening to a Middle of the Week show. I'm Bob Main. Thanks for tuning in. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Catch you next time. Goodbye.